This episode of Current Geek is brought to you by FreshBooks. The all-new FreshBooks is not only ridiculously easy to use, it's also packed full of powerful features. They're offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to listeners of this show. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/CG and enter Current Geek in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/CG and Current Geek on how you found it.
With the coming of the Second World War, many eyes in imprisoned Europe turned hopefully or desperately toward the freedom of the Americas. Lisbon became the great embarkation point, but not everybody could get to Lisbon directly. And so a tortuous roundabout refugee trail sprang up.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Welcome, everybody, to Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. But it's not so current today. Today, it's about throwing it back a little bit with our second film festival episode of Current Geek. I'm Scott Johnson with Tom Merritt. Hello.
This is a chance for us as geeks to steep ourselves in some of the best that the film medium has to offer. And I would argue that, yeah, no, it's not current, but it's still geeky, and the reason it's geeky is these movies that we watch, and this will become more apparent the more of these we do, underpin so many things. If there's anything about being geeky, it's cultural references, and these are the touchstones of cultural references that inform countless Simpsons and Futuramas and beyond.
Yeah, so much of what I would see as a kid on Saturday mornings in the world of animation, whether it was repeats of Bugs Bunny cartoons or something. Those were my entry into a lot of, like, the Edward G. Robinsons of the world or the Humphrey Bogarts of the world. Like
Peter Lorre.
Exactly. I would see them first in some, you know, Chuck Jones Bugs Bunny cartoon. And then only later I would go, oh, these were the big stars of that day. These were in their day, the modern cartoons that were making parody of what we would do today for George Clooney or for Matt Damon or somebody like that. And it never, you know, it was not that apparent at the beginning, but I knew I was watching something with some cultural significance, and it was nerdy for its time. Like, that's the nerdy way you make those references. And we get to do a little bit more of that today, maybe more today even than we did with our viewing of The Godfather, which, you know.
Yeah, so we created a list by averaging the rankings from the Rotten Tomatoes Top 100, where my wife works, IMDb ratings, and the AFI Top 100 films. And basically, films mentioned on only two of the lists had 101 points added to the score for weighting. Films that only appeared on one list had 150 points added for weighting. And otherwise, you got negative, you know, like if you were the number one on the list, you got 99 points, and that's how it worked. So we ended up with Godfather getting the most points, and number two on the list is the movie we're going to talk about today, Casablanca.
Oh, now, let's not forget, before we get too far into this thing, this isn't just number two on the list or one of the only movies that got that top spot. And if you look at anybody's top 100, Casablanca is always in the top five or so. It's always there. It also happens to be Tom Merritt's favorite movie of all time.
It is. Anytime anybody asks me what my favorite movie is, Casablanca is my answer.
Yeah.
And we'll talk in the course of this about the various reasons why. But every time I watch it, it gets better. Mm. And I think that's part of it for me. Mm. There's objective reasons, and there's reasons I can give about the structure and the lingo and the themes. But I watch it and I think, wow, this movie never loses me. I never get bored and want to walk out of the room. And I've seen it countless times.
Okay, so this is interesting because I come from the same exact generation as Tom. We were born the same year. We had the same kind of upbringing. We grew up in the 80s. We were exposed to...
We shared a womb.
One didn't happen, no. There was no vacancy when I checked that, so it didn't happen. But we lived at the same time. We grew up at the same time. We have a lot of the same sensibilities and tastes and everything else. But I've never seen this movie until this viewing. I've seen a million things about it. I know all about the quotes that come from it, and I've seen it used in other places. I've heard them used wrong because, you know, some of this stuff gets Mandela affected pretty bad. But I've never
Play It Again, Sam is the most famous example of that.
Yeah, totally. Outside of the Mandela story itself, that's right. Like number one. That and the Berenstein Bears or Berenstein or whatever it is. I can't even remember now. So, you know, Tom's got this like really deep rooted access to this film, seen it so many times. But this is my very first time. So I'm wondering, this is my question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Like, what was it that brought it to you in the first place and what kept you coming back? I remember at a young age, let's say 11 or 12, this sort of thing would absolutely not appeal to me. I would be like, that's grandma's movie. I don't watch this stuff. Where's the Goonies? Like, that's, I could care less about this. Now I have an appreciation for this sort of thing, but it took me a while. What was different there? Why did you dive in like that?
Well, I can think of a few reasons. One is, one of my favorite memories growing up is watching old movies on the weekend with my mom, especially on Saturdays when it was winter and it's snowing out and there's nothing you can't go out or it's raining. So we would watch Bowery Boys, Abbott and Costello, King Kong movies, Cary Grant movies, Humphrey Bogart movies. And I just got an appreciation for that feel. I probably saw Casablanca, but I don't remember it. Mm. Then when I got in high school and you could rent videos, you used to go down to the video store and get the VHS tapes. I started renting all these 40s and 50s movies. I was especially into the Cary Grant movies, but I was also very much into the Humphrey Bogart movies. And I rented Casablanca, and it just hit me at the time. Like, this is the period that I love to watch. This is Bogart. And it's a metaphor for World War II. And there was something about it that just captivated me. And then in college, we had to watch it for a film class that I took, and I gained an even greater appreciation for what goes on in it. And after that, it just always stuck with me. It's got all the great lines in film history. It's got these great performances. If there's one thing it doesn't have, it's great cinematography. Mm. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some great noir shots in here. There absolutely are. And the bars, the shadows that make bars in the background that sort of imply the prison aspect of Casablanca is great. But there's not cool angles. This is not The Third Man or anything like that. But I just think it's a rock solid story. And it came out the year my mom was born.
Yeah.
My mom was born November 16th, 1942. This movie came out 10 days later on November 26th in New York. It didn't go into wide release in the U.S. till January 23rd.
Yeah. Speaking of it being set in 42 or being rather filmed.
It's actually set in 41 before Pearl Harbor.
Right. So imagine, I always like to put myself in this context. I see it later and I go, oh, well, this is set in 41. This is prior to America's full entry into the war. This is when, you know, Germany's kind of having their way with Europe and all of that. And you forget what that might have been like to see this movie in 1942 at the height of our involvement in the war. And that's so like now happening. Like, in other words, what would it be today? I don't know. But if I was to guess, let's say one of the Iraqi conflicts. If we had a movie that comes out the year that is about this at the height of our involvement in the Iraq invasion, we didn't really have that.
Later. Not as titanic as World War II. No. World War II, really did subsume the world in a way that World War I didn't.
Yeah. Maybe a better comparison would be like, I realize it's more immediate, but if 9/11 happened in 2001, what would it have been like if in 2002, we had a movie that was about that and then all the stuff that came after that. It's such an immediacy.
I mean, 9/11 was traumatic and the effects carried on, but 9/11, you know, the bombing of the towers didn't keep going.
Right.
This is based on a play called Everybody Comes to Rick's that was written in 1941. Actually, it might have been 39, but it was written before the United States entered the war. And hence you get these themes of Humphrey Bogart, Rick Blaine, being America, being isolationist, saying, I don't want to be involved. And the play was sort of trying to make the point, but you can't not be involved. Then the movie is made after the U.S. has entered the war. So we're already involved. But now it's talking about why we got in, and it is full of Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that really gets me. Imagine you're America. You've just been drawn into this war in Europe. You're trying to beat the Nazis. You don't know everything about them, but you know they're bad. And you know that there are all of these immigrants flooding out of Europe to get away from the German invasion. Mm-hmm. And then you see a movie that has three Native Americans in it.
Mm-hmm.
Humphrey Bogart, the woman who played the Hungarian, mm-hmm. And I'm missing the other one.
There's another one, though.
They're all the actors are in the United States, right. But they're all from mostly European places. Yeah. I think there's one Mexican actress in here.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing all these people doing things in a place that they wouldn't want to be in, Casablanca, even seeing Paris before the invasion, while you know it's occupied by Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that just for context, it's crazy to think about that. It's hard to remember that because this stuff seems so old. Like anything that came or happened in pop culture before I was existing always feels weird and haunted to me because I don't have a reference point for it, right? I don't have a way to say, well, I was there and I remember that. And
yeah,
I'm sure this is true for any generation who comes
Dooley
later.
Dooley Wilson is the third American boy.
Oh, there you go.
The piano player.
Okay, same. There you go. So, yeah. Oh yeah, Dooley Wilson's great in this. So that brings
By the way, side note, Dooley Wilson is a drummer.
Right. Not playing.
He did not play the piano in Casablanca.
Right. I kind of bought into it, but I looked at that stuff later and I went, oh, okay, well, they fooled me. But anyway, here's why I think this holds up for you. Here's why I think it hit you in the first place as a powerful thing. And the reason it ends up on everybody's top five or in everyone's top 100 of all time. I think it's easy to see, even from my perspective as someone who's seeing it fresh. And that is that this feels like a movie made ahead of its time, a little bit out of its time, with techniques of both acting and directing and story flow, sort of plot rhythm, that is a more new construct. In other words, of movies made at that time, they were mostly like, oh, it's like a play. Here's act three. And they walk into the thing and they talk like this to each other. And there is some of that, right? These are all ex-radio people, and radio people brought that with them, and we didn't get the subtlety of how film acting might evolve until much later. But this movie somehow taps into that more than I expected and taps into real emotion. Like, normally when she's walking toward the plane with her activist husband and Bogart's back there waiting with French dude, played by a British actor who's amazing, Claude Rains.
Yeah.
Claude Rains is great. I didn't know about him like having a farm in Pennsylvania and like retiring there and all that. It was so awesome. Uh-huh. Reading all this cool stuff about him. Anyway, when that was happening, I was really feeling it. Like, straight up, like, I don't do that in black and white old 1940s movies. I barely do it in 50s movies, and you're lucky if there's a movie in the 60s that gets me there. But this movie resonates with real emotional heft, and that was unexpected for me because I went in not expecting it. I rarely get it with an old movie. I can sometimes appreciate what they were for what they were, but rarely do they actually get me in the heartstrings where they're attempting to get you. All these years later, it totally worked on me, and it surprised me. That really surprised me. So I guess my point is there's something there that sets it apart from its competition of the time, and makes it last, I guess.
There's something about the fact, in my estimation, there is not a wasted scene in the movie. Mm. Everything that happens moves the story along, sometimes in more ways than one. Yeah. And while it's not visually innovative, it's also not visually wasteful.
Mm.
So you know, in the early parts when you're seeing the people looking around in Casablanca, you're like, okay, we're getting the feeling of the refugees and the unsettlingness. When you see the people looking in fear at the police, there's so much that is being told to you visually, even if it's not that innovative in the way it's shot, that it just, there's not a wasted moment to me. Mm. And I think that is part of it. I think the other part of it is when you have a story about European refugees and your entire set is filled with European refugees, there's just going to be something intangible that's going to carry through that. And I think the pinnacle of that is the scene where they are singing the German anthem, not the German national anthem. I can't remember the exact song that they end up singing, But then the rest of Rick's breaks out in La Marseillaise and drowns them out. And supposedly, according to witnesses' testimony, people on the set were crying during that shooting of that scene.
Mm.
Because of what you're saying, like, these are people who really have been driven from their homes that they don't know if they're ever going to get back. We know. Mm-hmm. We know the war ends and Europe is freed. They don't.
Yeah, they have no idea. And maybe you just described the reason. Maybe we're picking up off this old black and white celluloid some truth that's hard to convey in any other way except that they're living it right then. And I realize these are actors and they're on sound stages and all of that, but they're living a time where things are very much uncertain. What's starting to bubble up in the Pacific is very, very uncertain. So like there's just so much unknown and so much fear and so much whatever that they successfully captured it and put it on film, maybe not even knowing that they were doing that as well as they did it.
Oh yeah.
You know,
no, I mean, this was something that, one of the writers, I believe it was Jules Epstein, found the play. It had not been produced, took it to Hal B. Wallace, the producer, and convinced him like, this is going to be great. You know, propaganda mm-hmm. office will love it. Cause it's all, you know, let's go beat the Nazis. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a great story. It was pushed up in its release to November to try to coincide with the invasion of North Africa by the Allied army.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just at the time thought to be another propaganda vessel. You throw Bargard and Bergman in there, and you put them escaping the Nazis and it'll get people to continue to be fired up. And there's hundreds of movies like that come out during this period, but somehow the work of the Epsteins, Julius and Philip Epstein, and there's a lot of controversy over how much Howard Koch was involved, but he does get a credit on the screenplay.
Right.
That screenplay ends up, as cobbled together as it is, just being a work of magic with some of the most memorable lines and the most memorable scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And it rises above. It ends up winning Academy Awards, although it has to get nominated twice. They put it in the 1943 Academy Awards because it came out in New York in November and it didn't win. And so they're like, well, it mostly came out in 43 and they put it in again. I don't think they'd let that happen anymore.
Yeah. I mean, he was given Best Actor nomination, but didn't win that in that nomination, which is a little surprising to me. In fact, I'm kind of the general opinion that most Humphrey Bogart movies I've seen, he's kind of the same guy in all of them. And they're kind of stereotyped and a little bit sort of typecast, but not this one. Like yeah. This one is way deeper. I mean, sure, there's all the sort of, well, the one swarthy American is making it work. And, you know, there's something there that they're trying to definitely push around. And I get that. But he transcends it in a way completely unexpected to me. I thought it was going to be a lot of, put that gun down now, Shane. Like just that whole thing was going to be this movie. And it wasn't that at all. It was nuanced. It was maybe one of the first movies I've ever seen from that era where a man's psyche, the way that we had set up men back then to be these mm-hmm. strong, masculine, trustworthy, swarthy men, and women were a little bit hysterical, like that whole stereotype. This is the first one I've seen where I felt like he was vulnerable. He had his weaknesses, his weak spots, his breaking points, what mattered to him. Like, he's a softy, but can't be in this hard world. And they explored that really well, like way earlier than I ever saw Hollywood do that.
Yeah.
And that's something.
One of the criticisms is the cinematography. The other criticism I've seen, and granted, most people love it. There's not a lot of criticism, but one of the other criticisms that I have seen is that the dialogue is hokey and it's full of cliches. And I think that's funny that these are some of the most memorable lines in cinema history and someone else is calling it hokey. But I can kind of see it. I kind of see what they're talking about. On the other hand, they work. Every hokey line, for me anyway, works.
Right.
It doesn't feel hokey. It feels like, oh no, everyone else who says this after this is hokey, but this is the first time it was ever said. It's not a stereotype yet.
Yeah.
And I know that's not true. A lot of these lines, you know, are mimicking previous works. Umberto Eco has a, you know, Umberto Eco's a semiotician. He's an Italian, so he's very dense in his thought. But he has a critique of this that talks about the fact that it's full of cliches, but then says it's so full of cliches that it becomes iconic and it becomes these archetypes mm-hmm. playing out on the stage. And that's why it transcends just being a stereotypical story.
I completely agree. It owns those things in a way that, that frankly, The Godfather did. We talked mm-hmm. about this exact same thing. Those Godfather lines that seem so rote and so I've heard them a billion times, you're hit suddenly with this notion that, oh, this is where I heard them. Or if it wasn't the first time I heard them, it was the most iconic, set in stone, this now belongs to this movie time I heard these lines. And Casablanca shares that. And I'm curious as we move forward through this list over time, if we're going to run into that a lot. We'll probably find that's true.
Well, I imagine that's one of the things that makes a movie show up at the top of these various lists is the fact that it doesn't feel... It feels like it's the first time for whatever it's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an interesting
what
point.
So what are the lines? This is one thing I was very curious about as I was watching it again, is what are the lines that are going to hit you like a ton of bricks where you're like, oh, that's where that came from?
I have two in particular. Now, there's a whole thing toward the end where he's talking to her about his plan to get her on that plane
mm-hmm.
that is... almost word for word, as soon as he started to say it, I almost feel like I could repeat it. Like, I've heard it so many times, that whole discussion, that's just a great chunk.
I mean, the
of
problems of two people in this world don't amount to a hill of beans.
That's
in this
the one. That's yeah. the one. I also have a question about hill of beans, but we'll get to that in a second. But I captured two of the lines Three that jump out at me. Here's the first one. It's about 6 seconds long. This is definitely iconic for this movie, in my opinion.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Yeah, so I mean, how do you get away from that one? That one's pretty...
I forget that is in this movie, and this is my favorite movie. And I'll be watching it, and I'm like, oh, right, that's from this.
Yeah.
Because that line itself has taken on a line of its own by being in so many noir movies mm-hmm. after that where they're parodying it mm-hmm. that it's sort of unmoored itself from mm-hmm. Casablanca.
And so... In my weird head, there's like, for some reason, Star Wars has that line in it. I know it doesn't. I know it doesn't, but there's something about that. Well, it's just like,
there's
you know,
something about that line that feels like it's supposed to be spoken
yeah.
by a detective, you know, who's, it's like, well, detectives don't own gin joints, but yeah, it's different than like, oh, that's about an expat in Casablanca hiding from the Nazis whose old French lover shows up with her husband who escaped from a concentration camp. It's like, no, that's not what I got from that line.
Mm-hmm.
I just got like, noir guy is upset that the dame walked in.
Yeah, it's a total dame line. Like, and it's from, you know, it would go back to like Private Eye, whatever guy
yeah,
in his
yeah.
room. And it's almost internal dialogue often is what
I want to get back to more of these lines, but that reminds me of something. Did you watch the trailer? By any chance?
No, I meant to do that and didn't do
Go
it.
Go back and watch the trailer when you get a chance. It's hilarious because it is giving, it is promising you that movie that you thought you were going to see.
Oh.
It's all about Rick Blaine with his gun and he's going to shoot the Nazis and the wow. Nazis are running after him and can't, but he falls in love and he's a tough guy and it's promising an entirely different movie than what you get.
Do they do the big splashy words up on the screen the way they
used
to
yeah.
do it?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
I
yeah.
love that. My favorite thing about those were those. Here's the other line that is definitely iconic for me.
Is looking at you, kid.
Obviously. And that gets used a few times. Not the...
Three times,
yeah. First time in Paris, second time in that room, third time at the end.
And also, the story on that
yeah.
is it's not in the script.
Oh, really?
That it's something Bogart said to... Bergman, I want to say, mm-hmm. I might have that part wrong, when he was at the poker table trying to teach how to convincingly play poker, and he says it, and this part of the story I'm fuzzy on, but either someone hears him and says, you should use that, or he just gets in the habit of it and starts saying it, but it's ad-libbed by him, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love to hear that kind of stuff. I love ad-libs that turn out to be like... big moments that no one ever forgets. Those are my favorites. So one thing I was going to say about the director, Michael Curtis, mm-hmm. with a Z, is an Austrian/Hungarian director, and he was born there in 1886, died in 62 at age 75, did a bunch of movies in between. question for you is, do you think he ever quite reached the height of what Casablanca would be in movie history? He's known for a lot of the Robin Hood, Errol Flynn things.
Yeah, so Robin Hood, I don't know exactly when Curtis died. I can look that up real quick. But my guess is he died feeling like he was best known for Robin Hood. Mm. That Errol Flynn Robin Hood movie, it's kind of faded in our memories somewhat these days. But that was his big achievement. He died in 1962, so Casablanca had started to really become iconic by that time. So maybe, maybe not. But yeah, I mean, Robin Hood and White Christmas and Casablanca. Those are his big achievements.
A couple of Westerns in there. That Mildred Pierce movie I've seen.
Oh, like, yeah. No, there's plenty of other things that are recognizable, but I think those are the big three. He did the least popular of the jazz singers.
Oh, I was going to ask.
The Al Jolson one that brought about talkies.
Yeah.
And then there's Neil Diamond.
Yeah. The Robin Hood thing reminds, so being known for that is for a director, it's got to be like, I don't know. I can't think of a good example, modern times though, but like, you know, 50 years from now, people will look back at George Lucas. What are they going to think of? Well, they're only going to think of Star Wars. That's it. They're not going to think of, the THX movie or the other one with where it's set in the 50s. I forgot the name of it all of a sudden. American Graffiti. They're not going to remember those. They'll be there and there'll be some guys on some future holographic podcast who reference those and goes, oh, did you know we also made this, you know, American Graffiti movie? Remember that? Oh, yeah, that was good. Ron Howard was in it. Like, well, they'll have this same kind of experience. So maybe that was kind of his thing where the big blockbuster popcorn movie overshadowed his great work, and it would take years for his great work to be seen. The problem with my comparison is George Lucas's great work is Star Wars, so it's not quite the same.
Yeah, but it's more like I don't know, James Cameron thinking that, you know, Titanic is his big movie, and then like Avatar ends up becoming beloved in the future, or something,
or the other way around, possibly.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, so it's, I don't know. That's interesting. I always like to see, you know, who makes these things, not only who writes and who directs them, but also how they handle certain subject matter of the era. So I wanted to at least throw this little piece out. The piano player, Sam. This is an African American in a movie during a time where they didn't get a lot of roles, and the roles they did get were very subservient and secondary. And all of that. Now, not to say this isn't a secondary role, because it, I mean, clearly is. He's a supporting player. But I went in there expecting all kinds of racial insensitivity. And there wasn't any, really. Like, it was a great friendship. And he, I mean, again, we're talking 41 here, everybody, or the era of 41. So, you know, Rick slapping Sam on the back and saying, hey, keep going, or hey, play that song I like, or hey, it's good to see you, or whatever, checking in on him, having that friendship exist, I think was probably a big deal at the time. Now, I may be projecting 2017 values to a troubled racist past during the era of World War II, but I was heartened by that, I guess, and a little surprised.
It's sort of a, you know, you got to grade on a curve. Is having one African American character in Africa a progressive movie? Certainly not.
Right.
Is he the most progressive character? No, he's not.
No.
For the time, though, they don't have him, you know, shucking and jiving, at least not too much. Right. They do have him as a valued friend of Rick, such to the point that they make a point of telling what's his face Green Street's character, Signor Ferrari, I don't buy and sell people. Like, that's like slapping you in the face 1942 stuff. So yeah, I mean, you consider the time, and it is well done. If you made this movie now, people would be criticizing.
Sure. What, remind me the name of the play again. Everybody Goes to Rick's.
Everybody Comes to Rick's.
Why can I? Okay. I have a confession to make. This was caused me problems for the entire 2-hour run of the thing, or whatever it was, hour and 40 minutes. I can't stop thinking of Rick and Morty every time anyone says the name Rick. Like, it's ruined me, because all you can, even when you said it earlier, like, everyone goes to Rick's.
That's not a problem I had.
Oh, but, drove me crazy. I mean, part of it is, it seems like a strange
Pickle
name.
Rick!
It feels like a newer name and not one you'd see in an old movie, but.
Oh, it's Richard, is it?
Yeah, Richard.
Oh, it's Richard. So we're back in Paris.
Pickle Richard. Anyway, Pickle. That was in my head.
That would be Pickled.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I also, these are the esoteric things that go through my head when I watch old things. All right, we're going to take just a moment and talk about our friends at FreshBooks. So look, you're racing against the clock to wrap up three projects, prepping for a meeting later in the afternoon, all while trying to tackle a mountain of paperwork. Your inbox is full, blah, blah, blah. Welcome to life as a freelancer. Tom and I can attest to this. Is it challenging? Yes, but our friends at FreshBooks believes the rewards are very, very much worth it. They're working on some rad stuff, and I want to tell you guys about it. Your working world has changed. With the growth of the internet, there's never been more opportunities for the self-employed. And to meet this need, FreshBooks is excited to announce the launch of the all-new version of their cloud accounting software. It's been redesigned from the ground up and built for exactly the way you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quicker. The all-new FreshBooks, not only ridiculously simple to use, but also packed with powerful features like creating and sending professional-looking invoices in less than 30 seconds, set up online payments with just a couple of clicks, and get paid up to 4 days faster. I like that one a lot. And see when your client has seen your invoice. That way you can end that guessing game that often happens. They're offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our listeners. To claim it, go to FreshBooks.com/CG. That's short for Current Geek, CG. And enter Current Geek in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Do it today. You'll love it. FreshBooks is fresh. Almost all of these people. So here we have Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart, who is the real actor. The actor was 42 when this was filmed.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing 37, and he looked 60. And I'm always blown away by that, right? Yeah. Like, it's just, it must be the smoking. I don't know. I don't know what else to attribute it to, because
there's something else with Bogart, though, because he looks that age his entire life.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he looks a tiny bit younger in his early 30s roles.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, like, and he died young. He died in his 50s.
Yeah, 59.
He looks the same age pretty much through his entire life.
Yeah, and there's a good number of these people in this movie, mostly the men, all die in their 50s, the actors. Mm-hmm. And the women all live on to be 80 plus.
Oh, Madeleine LeBeau, who plays Yvonne.
Yeah.
She's the one, but Yvonne, I love you.
Yeah.
She died in 2016.
Yeah, just barely.
Just a year ago. A little more than a year ago now. May 2016.
Which brings me to my whole reason for bringing this up. I think she may have been the final holdout.
She was. She was the last surviving Casablanca actress.
That's crazy to me. All of these people, when I see a thing, any kind of movie or TV show, and it hits me that everybody on screen that's moving around and talking is no longer doing that, it weirds me out, man. Freaks me out completely. I know that's a weird, dumb thing, but it's been a thing for me my whole life. If I see something like that, it's just like,
does that
freak
you out when you read Charles Dickens too?
A little bit.
Oh, the guy wrote this is dead.
A little bit. I'll read a book from an author who I know has passed away even recently, and it's still just,
it's weirder when it's recent, right?
Because
you're like, oh wow, this voice isn't around anymore.
Yeah, but then it kind of is, you know, like it's still there.
Yeah.
And just like this movie is still there. And
well, that's it. These folks are immortal.
Yeah.
And I'm going to embarrass a couple of friends of ours right now.
All right.
Because since I met them and I watch Casablanca, this always goes through my head. The first time you see Ilsa and Rick meet in Rick's as a viewer, the first time you see them meet, I always go, oh my gosh, it's the Spags.
Ah, that's funny. That's pretty great.
I'm not trying to say that Mark Spagnuolo looks 65 either.
No, he's getting there though.
Yeah.
He's,
no, that's not what I'm
saying. He's working on it. He's getting there. Another thing that jumped out at me is this was the era, if you're going to have a kissing scene or some sort of romantic conversation moment, all the Vaseline lenses come out.
Yeah.
Really never understood that and still don't, but hey, whatever, it's fine.
Because it just makes you look younger. It makes you look soft and vulnerable and sexy. And
sure.
You don't see any imperfections.
I guess so. Everyone looks all watery-eyed. And
yeah, yeah.
And that was the thing of the day. And I'm sure we do something like this today. The one I don't like of that, there's some of these effects work, some of them don't. The one I don't like is in the 70s or the 60s even. And they did this on Star Trek a lot, where the TV show, where they would kind of put a shadow for half of the face. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know what that's called.
That's a noir thing.
I don't like that at all.
Because it's trying to show that this character is divided. He's not good or bad. He's chaotic, neutral.
It should show that the lighting in the room is broken because it doesn't look right, and it never has. All right. Also, the Nazi guy, you know, our colonel, whatever his name is.
Strasser.
There you go.
Major Strasser.
Actual German actor, which is kind of cool.
I know, poor guy.
Yeah.
Had to flee Germany because of the Nazis, and then end up playing Nazis his entire life.
Yeah, pretty much his entire life. But also kind of rad that he could do that in 42. Like, it's just, that's crazy to me. But
yeah.
But anyway, he didn't turn out to be this big laughable German stereotype that I expected. I thought I was going to get like this propagandist sort of take on Germans and Nazis. And instead, he's very procedural. He's very, well, we're here, we're occupying it, we have rules. Like, there's kind of a practicality to the depiction of the Third Reich here that really, really impressed me for the time.
Germans must get used to all climates.
But you know what I mean? They weren't just like, Gestalt, Verdacht, 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 and they aren't like smacking their heels together.
They're not stepping around. Yeah. There is something practical about this entire movie, which is another reason that I love it. I think it was Wallace, the producer, insisted that the parrot in the blue parrot be a real parrot.
Yeah.
You don't put a stuffed parrot. You don't put another bird up there and say it's a parrot. You get a parrot. And there's little things like that throughout that show attention to detail that really, you know, you may not notice them, but they help immerse you that you were really there. And part of that is the blasé nature of people who are at wit's end. They're like in neutral territory. And I think that's another hard thing to wrap your head around is in the modern movie, the Germans would come in and crush, you know, Renault and say, no, this is our land now. But there's this weird political no man's land where Germany is trying to maintain the fiction of a free France. Mm-hmm. And so they have to respect, you know, for now, eventually they'll roll over them. But for now, they have to respect that, which means they can't just come in and arrest Victor Laszlo, even though they'd like to. So they've got to work around it and either fake his death or something. But it's this weird thing where like, no, I mean, you'd think the Nazis would just come in and shoot him and leave. Mm-hmm. But it's well explained to me anyway that no, this is kind of this weird port, and the Free French, like Renault, were just left there. They were France until Paris fell, mm-hmm. and now they're Free France. But are they? Because they're Africa, and they weren't picking a side other than France before this. So and all that complexity is just playing out behind everything that happens.
Right. And I love that. That's hard to do because what you're trying to do is tell a very human story on top of that. So you're just trying to say, all right, star-crossed lovers, you know, weird France memories. Turns out now she's with the resistance and her husband's this big deal. And how are you going to resolve that? And he's just trying to live his life out there and get away from all this craziness and run his joint and do his thing. But now he's being dragged back in. And like, it's all these human things we get, we understand at a ground level. It's very grassroots. But behind it all, that tapestry is moving, and that's hard. That's hard to do, and to keep your attention and to remind you that it's happening without it being too prominent in the movie. Like,
well,
the best...
and they speak German without subtitles. Yep. They speak French without subtitles. They speak Italian. You know, like it just, it's like, no, you're really here, folks. You're really in Casablanca for the hour and 45 minutes that you're gonna watch.
It feels
this.
Very raw that way, and I really like that. I also think that Captain Renault, the character played by Claude Rains, is understated to the point of near genius for me. I think he's amazing in this, and he's the first, well, not the first I'd seen, but I think maybe I'm looking at the, again, this may not be the origin of this, but it feels now very original. he may be the first really good example of that guy who is really sort of just in it for himself and is using his position of power to appease the newcomers and to try to maintain peace. But really, that's not his main motive. I mean, he's basically willing to sleep with the villain if he needs to get what he wants out of all of this. Like, there's a real...
Well, he's actually much more willing to sleep with particular visa seekers.
Oh, for sure. And I forgot about it. Very subtle, by the way, that stuff. But also probably in 41, not so subtle. But
well, they had to dial it back, apparently. Mm-hmm. The voluntary censors kind of struck some things from the script. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting point, too. The idea that Rick slept with Ilsa is sort of left there on the table.
Right.
When she visits him and you're like, oh, no, because they're still having a conversation when Victor shows up. Sure. So no. But then later he makes a point of saying to Victor, she came to my room pretending she still loved me. Mm-hmm. But I know it wasn't true, but she pretended it was.
And he says, I pretended right along with her or whatever.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, so you did. Okay.
Yeah.
And again, it's all, you know, it's all very subtle, like you said, but yeah. in the play, it was much more straightforward because in the play, she doesn't meet Victor until after, he leaves Paris.
Oh.
Rick leaves Paris. Then she meets Victor. So there's that extra little added twist where she thinks her husband's dead. So that makes it okay.
Yeah.
But she was married, then was with Rick and then found out she was married, which I think is a much better way of handling that story.
Sure. Yeah, I think I agree. But it's just, I don't know, that stuff's handled really well. And again, surprisingly non-cartoonish and non-two-dimensional for a movie this old, because they used to kind of go for that. And that was okay, because back in the day, you know, it was radio plays and actual plays, and you were to enunciate and face the camera, and, you know, like they had all these rules written or unwritten.
I always think about older stuff like this, too, and I'm like, the fact that someone is on a screen talking to you is entertainment, mm-hmm. right? We mm-hmm. take that for granted. We're like, well, of course they're talking. It's television.
Yeah, back then.
But that was huge.
Yeah. Back then it must have felt foreign in a lot of ways, for a lot of years anyway, after talkies became a thing. But he went on to be, back to Renault, one mm-hmm. of the characters that most resonated with me. And I've seen a million like him since. And I tried to think of a bunch of them, but it's like people in cahoots who in the end end up doing something redemptive. But they're in cahoots the rest of the movie and it kind of pisses you off. And sometimes they make the ultimate sacrifice and sometimes they don't. But there's a Han Solo quality to him. I just need to get mine. I don't care about anybody else sort of quality that you can apply to a lot of different characters. He's kind of Captain Malcolm Reynolds a little bit. Like, I know these are stretches, but they're...
No, actually, Allura for Real is pointing out he's more of a Lando character.
Yeah, it's like Lando. There you go, Lando.
Yeah.
Duh. We got to get to that. What did we hear? Like, he is totally Lando.
This deal with the Nazis gets worse and worse all the time.
Pray I don't change it any further, or whatever he says. But anyway, here's the other question for you. Was the 40s the time where it doesn't matter how big a profile a resistance fighter you are, you better make sure you're dressing up every night and going to the local popular restaurant/bar. Like, well,
the way they did it in the 40s, man. That's why I love it.
Why wouldn't you hide? You'd hide, wouldn't you? You wouldn't.
Everybody's
go
in style.
It just seems like you wouldn't go out in public.
You mean if you're Victor Laszlo?
Yeah.
Like, well, okay. You're in unoccupied France, yeah. right? And there aren't always Germans there. So yeah, of course you're going to go out because everybody knows you're there, but you're safe because you're in unoccupied France. So you can move around freely. You just got to be careful who hears your conversations and who sees whom talking to whom. Mm-hmm. When you do bring the Germans in though, suddenly I'm like, But would you choose to go to the restaurant that day? Like, I mean, I know you're trying to meet Ugarte and you don't know he's dead. So you might be, he's brave enough that maybe he thinks he can get away with it. But that question does kind of hover at the back of my mind.
Yeah. And it's a small thing, but you know, I just don't know that all these people would be hiding in plain sight like that. It's almost like also the papers were in the piano the whole time. It's just weird. Oh, can we talk about the papers?
The letters of transit.
Yes. Yeah. Can you tell me? I'm still unsure what the hell those were for.
Okay. So it's a MacGuffin. Okay. So you really don't want to look too closely at them.
All right.
And I've never, you know, I should do this one of these days. I've never looked into the actual legality. Like, how did letters of transit really work? Wouldn't the Germans just be like, no, you can't travel? Mm. But the idea of them is that they are signed by General de Gaulle, who was Free France. He continued to fight for the resistance, but in Free France, again, in this weird world where the Germans are trying to pretend that France is not occupied, things that are French have to be respected. And these are signed by the highest authority that say the bearer of this letter is allowed transit. And so a French official who's looking at your papers to see if you board sees this letter of transit and says, oh, well, you have basically the president's permission to get on this plane. I cannot question that. Why there were German couriers with them, I don't know. Why they didn't have someone's name already filled in on them, I don't know.
Right. And they never explain it. It's not explained.
Yeah. No, but it's a MacGuffin. It's a thing that's like, oh, these are the paper. These are the get out of jail free papers. So if you get them, you win.
Yeah, I think that sounds like the only explanation we need. I mean, it's not important. It's only important to know that it's like this weird pivot thing that creates drama and everybody needs them or whatever. And I think I'm okay with that. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's the Death Star plans. Like
it's exactly it. Yeah. It's the Death Star plans. And I can imagine certain, especially as bureaucratic as Nazi Germany was, I can imagine situations where certain papers might have that effect. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say it's, even if I don't quite understand how it works in this case, I'm not going to say it's wholly improbable.
Right. But it does, you know, whatever, fine. Transit papers. Get them today. They're the hot new thing, everybody.
Well, they're hard to get, right? They give you these magic powers to travel anywhere, but they're also impossible to get a hold of.
The movie does not know how to say the word visa. I'm going to play a selection of this. They don't know how to say the word visa very well. They can say transit papers or papers of transit, but they can't say
letters of transit.
Letters of transit, but they can't say this.
Might obtain exit visas and scurry to Lisbon.
Visas?
Yeah, that's actually the proper pronunciation.
That's a terrible way to say it. I hate it.
Well, because the proper plural would be V-I-S-A-E-S.
Yeah.
And the proper pronunciation is visa, not visa.
Okay, but if you say visa or visas.
Visas.
So visas is the right way to do it?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate it.
Just, we got lazy.
Visas.
It's like someday when library will be spelled without an R, because that's just the way everybody says it.
Hey, that assumes we have libraries in the future.
Yeah, probably.
This is a conversation. They were trying to establish early that, hey, a lot of wheeling and dealing is going on in this bar/restaurant. People will meet with those who can maybe shuttle them out or get deals or get them fake papers and documents and that sort of thing. And I liked this guy with his jewelry thing, so I'm going to play that.
Sorry, madame, but diamonds are a drug on the market. Everybody sells diamonds. There are diamonds everywhere. 2,400.
I'm just trying to imagine a world where too many diamonds is a problem, but apparently it was a problem.
No, and that's actually, that's one of those little believable things where you're like, wow, there's that many people with all of their worldly possessions moving through that diamonds are like, hey, you know what? We have a lot of diamonds right now. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's hard to move them too, because there's a war on. So yeah,
exactly. Yeah. There's a good part about a little exchange about why he's here. I captured it. We'll play this.
I've often speculated on why you don't return to America. Did you abscond with the church funds? Did you run off with the senator's wife? I like to think that you killed a man. It's the romantic in me.
It's a combination of all three.
And what in heaven's name brought you to Casablanca?
My health. I came to Casablanca for the waters.
The waters? What waters? We're in the desert.
I was misinformed.
That's great stuff.
I love that. I was misinformed. Yep. Like the banter.
It's so good. And it's nonstop. Like the dialogue in this movie is impressive. Mainly because you're getting tons of information. And part of that rhythm I think comes from this, but it's just nonstop. Nobody's leaving big gaps of space anywhere. And some may say, well, I like movies that take their time and breathe and look and stare.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's places for that, surely. But there's something about it in here that's perfect. And the actors, the way they bounce off of each other. And Claude Rains can just eat the scenery. That guy's just great.
Yeah, he really can. Yeah. The other thing that's amazing about all these memorable lines, play it again, Sam, is never said. Mm-hmm. Play it, Sam, is said by Ilsa first, actually, and then later in a version by Rick. But a lot of them are accidental. Mm-hmm. So like Play It Again, Sam is made up by us because we love the fact that there's this play it, Sam. I want you to play it. Right.
Yeah.
Then there's the lines like here's looking at you, kid, that were just made up by Humphrey Bogart. And then the final line of the movie, Louie, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, that's another one.
Was written by the producer, Hal Wallace, after they'd finished shooting.
Yeah.
Wow. He decided they played around with like adding a scene of Rick and Renault fighting together after they both escaped from Casablanca. And then they're like, no, let's not mess with this. And so Wallace came up with that final line and had Bogart come in and dub it.
Mm.
So, which is why you see Bogart's from behind walking away when you hear him say,
yeah, they're walking off into the fog.
Yeah.
Which Casablanca has so much fun.
I looked at it, you know, first time I ever saw this, I'm like, whoa, what a beautiful way to end this. Like have them walk off in the fog and talk about their friendship and head off into the unknown. And it's kind of accidental.
Yeah. It seems like lots of happy accidents were going on there. I was going to mention this. Where was it? Oh, Hill of Beans. Can we talk about Hill of Beans for just a second?
Sure.
My dad said this constantly growing up. Scott, you're not going to amount to a hill of beans unless your grades get up. Scott, you're never going to get your license if you don't do this work, and none of this is going to amount to a hill of beans, he would say, all the time. And now I wonder, because I hear this in the movie, and I went, oh my gosh, it's like my dad. But then I went, oh, maybe this is where my dad got it. So,
right?
Origin of the term hill of beans, I just have to know, is it this movie? And maybe we don't know this, but... I could find out Hill of Beans.
Yeah, I'm looking. I'm trying to look it up myself. It's in the dictionary in the Merriam-Webster.
Let's see. You could, for example, say it's a bad idea. It's not worth a hill of beans. Let's see. Worldwide words. Hill of beans.
Hill of beans. Hill of beans. Yeah, because I remember people saying it around me too, and I don't know if they got it from that.
Yeah. There's also, it says here, recently an expression of hill of beans have been used by Samuel L. Jackson in a Barclays commercial, recent Vodafone commercial. And then this thing goes on to ask where it came from. They do say that it was talked in.
Expression was first used almost 700 years ago. Robert of Gloucester described a message from the King of Germany to King John of England as altogether not worth a bean.
That's hilarious. So the hill of beans thing. Oh, you're right. There it is. The expanded formula of Hill of Beans is very American, it says. From the evidence, it seems to have appeared in the modern sense about 1860. And then they go on to reference the movie as a place where it was popularly coined. So, again, this could be one of those things that's like an ancient thing, but that movie brought it to the forefront, and then my dad used it for the rest of my life. That's what it kind of feels like. But
Yeah. And probably. It was probably something people said. And then the movie popularized it. How many times has that happened in your life?
Sure. Now, as we wind down here, there is a small technical thing I would like some clarification on. And maybe we know the answer to this and maybe we don't. But there was a...
Is it that you're shocked that there's gambling?
Well, that... Okay, that's part of it. It's gambling related. There's the scene where the girl, the young girl who's going off with that dude is around the roulette table. And he says, put it all on 22, boy. And he puts it on 22, and it wins, and then it wins again. And he says, all right, grab all your...
Oh, yeah, that's Anina. She's Joy Page, one of the three U.S.-born actors.
Right, there you go. Is it... How was he cheating? I don't understand.
We don't know.
Okay,
I'm not supposed to know. But one can assume that in a properly run Casablanca gambling establishment that... The fix can be in whenever it needs to be.
Okay, so because it seemed like all he did was just say... Like flicked his eyes at the guy that was talking, but he doesn't have some secret lever somewhere.
You see what's his name? I can't remember his name. The guy running the roulette wheel. You see him kind of playing with the table.
Mm.
And honestly, I don't think they bothered. They're like, we don't need to show this. But I think the idea was like there was probably a button down there that when he pressed it, it activated a magnet that made 22 always be where the ball ended up.
Yeah, I get hung up on those things. I shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that important, but for
reason. Like I said, this is the millionth time I've watched this. I was thinking that too. Like, I wonder wonder how that would have been done.
Yeah, I don't know. Because it seems like it's a big wheel. Even if you put a magnet there, how are you going
to
ensure?
Oh, you can fix a roulette wheel. You do a Google search. There are plenty of ways to fix a roulette wheel. How they actually pulled it off at Rick's without having it always there, I don't know.
Yeah, and they never explain where he got... I mean, they kind of explain where he got his money, that he would be able to afford to open this place and run it. Like, they didn't get into any of the business stuff. And it kind of annoys me that I care about those things. But I always,
that is actually of the time period, in my opinion, yeah. Which is if you're an American in Paris, you must have had some money.
Mm.
And if you go to Casablanca, things are super cheap.
Yeah.
Anybody who's traveled to places, Thailand used to be more like this, I am told. I've never been there, where you can, like, you know, spend $20 and live like a king in a hotel room that's, you know, super luxe. And it's that kind of economy in Casablanca, especially with the war on. So if he had any money at all, he probably had a pretty easy time putting up some collateral and buying a place.
I could see that. When I was in China, and also when I was in Mexico, same kind of thing happened where suddenly a wallet with $50 in it meant the prince of the world was there. And you forget that there's still places in the world like that today. But I guess, at the time you have your ways. And in a way it illustrates taking advantage of a less knowing culture or something, or a culture that doesn't see you coming.
A less economically stable culture.
Sure. And that's interesting in its own right. So yeah. I kind of got a vibe of that. Like, I'm just surprised that I got so many like realness out of this movie, like vibes that felt real instead of just the artifice that is 1940s cinema.
Well, and again, I keep going back to it, but I think part of it is that multinational cast.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, there are other things in it that lend themselves to that impression, but that really strikes it home when you're like, wow, that's Carl is really not American. Mm-hmm. Like he's actually not German.
It's
either,
like it's like an authenticity that for whatever reason, I just didn't think existed then. And I was wrong. Casablanca has it and it's great. I'm genuinely surprised how much I liked it. I liked it a lot. Now, am I ready to be Tom Merritt and say it's my favorite movie ever? Probably not, but it might be my favorite old movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's hard
for
me.
Your favorite pre-1970 movie.
Yeah. Like it's good. I'm trying to think of anything else that competes, and though I'm probably not nearly as versed as some in terms of how many they've seen total or whatever, but I can't think of anything else. I mean, Maltese Falcon I really like, but that's also Bogart. It's kind of the same, a lot of the same vibes. Yeah, Peter Lorre as well.
And the amazing Mr. Sidney Greenstreet.
Yeah, that one may come up on our list. If there's 100 of them. Yeah, we'll see. Well, anyway, the movie is Casablanca. I rented it. It's not streaming anywhere, unfortunately. I think it'd be nice if it did. There's a documentary I've now marked to watch later on Amazon Prime that is about this and movies like it of the time. So I just saw that it had 4.5 stars and I'm going to see what that is. So I got lucky there. But yeah, if you're trying to get hold of this thing, it's rentable/buyable everywhere that streaming stuff is available. And of course, discs and that sort of thing as well.
You know, side note, this was the movie that I tested Voodoo's disc to digital with.
Mm.
I had a DVD copy. I still have a DVD copy of it. And I was like, all right, fine. Let me try out the disc to digital. And then disc to digital gave me a Voodoo copy of it, which gave me an ultraviolet copy of it, which now has given me a Movies Anywhere copy of it.
Wow.
And I started to watch it on Apple because it showed up in my library and it wouldn't play.
Oh.
It was all weird, like wrong encoding. So I had to go launch the Voodoo app and then play it, and then it was fine.
Oh, okay, good. But that's good to know that works that well. That's surprising to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just thought that was hokum when people would say you could do that. But Tom, the tech maven of the internet, has proved me otherwise.
Once again,
proving us all wrong. Here's the other thing. It's probably worth owning. Like, I feel like that's a good movie to own. Are there, as far as you know, I couldn't find any. I looked, but are there other versions? Are there any kind of director's cuts or any kind of weird?
They didn't do that back then.
Okay.
I mean, we're lucky because it won an Academy Award. Probably we're lucky we have actual prints of it. A lot of movies from that era just got lost. They just got shuffled away.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't know, in today's world of everything can be archived and made into a thing we can see. I don't know. Felt good to have
director's cuts don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world.
That's right. You know what? If you're looking for beans, though, you could do a lot worse than a hill. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of beans, especially during the war.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no expert, but it seems like if you're looking for beans, a hill of beans is the answer to your prayers. Anyway, we hope you guys enjoyed this one-off or the second off. Whatever. It's not a one-off. We're going to be doing these like once a month and regular episodes in between. We hope you guys are enjoying them. So far, it seems like people are. And if you've got your own ideas about Casablanca, your own feelings about what the movie is, what it should mean, or how you'd like to talk about it, you have a voice on this show. currentgeek@gmail.com is your email address you can use. Tom Merritt, before we go, is there anything you'd like to say before we leave?
Well, first of all, Casablanca is followed by Citizen Kane, Psycho, and Sunset Boulevard on our list. And yes, The Maltese Falcon is down there on the list as well.
Wow. So. What is the most, when do we get to a movie that isn't this old? Do you know? Because I think
Psycho is 1960. Godfather Part II is 74. So Godfather was 72.
Yeah, that's true.
Star Wars is 77. First 80 movie would be E.T.
Oh, okay. There you go. So, yeah, I think I was full of myself and thought only good movies were made in the 80s and forward. And I don't think that's true anymore.
Yeah.
I really did.
I almost think it's the opposite.
It's probably the opposite. You're probably right. But, you know, as a kid of the 80s,
yeah,
I've learned in my adulthood that I was wrong.
So let me remind people that I have a new book out called Poveria.
Yeah.
The Poveria has been cut off from the other colony starships due to an ancient prohibition against powering its broken engines. And Nath is volunteered to travel to the far end of the ship to search for the last notes of Bev Bora, which may reveal the secret to restoring full power. But somebody doesn't want him to find them. And you can find out who that is by buying a copy of Poveria and reading it today.
Nice. Nath is a great name. I like that a lot.
Nath stands for Ranganathan.
Oh, very nice. Even better. Yeah. I need to read the book. There you go. Check that out, everybody. In the meantime, if you'd like to get with us, currentgeek.com. We'll be back.
You got
to
get with our friends.
We'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll be at BlizzCon next week, so no show. But we'll be back the following Friday with something rad. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you then.
We'll always have Paris.
Will we, though? Will we?
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we celebrate my favorite sport, college football, being in full swing with a look at the latest frontier in lawsuits against universities for using the likenesses of players in commercial contexts. NCAA football has been under a fairly constant barrage of legal challenges, thanks to the money generation shooting to astronomical levels, with very little compensation trickling down to the players that help make this product so popular. As you'll recall, the NCAA itself pulled out of the video game market thanks to a lawsuit from a former player for not sharing the wealth from those licensing deals. And current players have made moves as well, like the Northwestern team considering unionizing, also previously covered on this segment. The tide is rising in favor of compensating players, and another step in that direction took place a few weeks ago when Chris Spielman, a TV personality and former NFL player and linebacker at The Ohio State University, sued his alma mater in federal court as the lead plaintiff of a class action lawsuit for antitrust violations associated with marketing activities done by OSU and their marketing firm IMG College. For any familiar with OSU football, the mere thought of a lawsuit entitled Spielman v. OSU is shocking. Spielman has promised to turn any winnings in the case back over to the university, so this is really just to make a point and push against the current way the university uses the likenesses of former players in marketing materials. For example, OSU and IMG do deals with companies like Nike and Honda, and banners have been hung in the stadium and elsewhere with old Buckeye greats like Spielman and the company logos on them. Spielman, being one of the most iconic former OSU players, is typically one of the ones depicted, but he receives no royalty for the use of his likeness as a former player, nor is he consulted about these ads. One under-the-radar reason Spielman is personally motivated to lead this lawsuit is that he has a 20-year relationship helping a Columbus, Ohio car dealership that sells Mazdas and Subarus. That makes his association with competitor Honda in such a public forum kind of problematic for his ability to leverage his own fame and likeness for a profit in those endeavors. That helps explain the antitrust claims in the lawsuit, which claim that OSU and its partners have illegally restrained trade on exploitation of the likenesses of former players, which adversely affects the rights and opportunities for those former players. Spielman argues the players deserve some control in this matter, as well as compensation. Once again, college football and universities are on the firing line for making a bunch of money without the participation of the players. Another salvo in the ongoing battle over the ever-increasing pots of money that this sport generates. Ohio State has recently moved to dismiss the federal case based on sovereign immunity of state agencies, while marketing firm IMG has filed a motion to dismiss based on failure to state an actionable claim. If those motions succeed, the lawsuit would likely move to state court, but Ohio does not have a right of publicity law that favors Spielman and former players in this type of circumstance. However, the cat may be out of the bag, even if OSU succeeds, as other universities may then face challenges in states with more protective laws for these rights. The bottom line is, as long as the money for marketing and television deals stays so ridiculously high, universities will likely remain under attack from multiple angles until players, current and former, are properly compensated. This case, while shocking to OSU fans, may be the next big landmark in progress towards what many believe to be fair, paying the players a reasonable wage, even in this so-called amateur context. We will keep our eyes on the courts in Ohio for further developments as much as we do on the current teams fighting on the field for a national championship. And because it's me, go Buckeyes. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.